This episode of Super Pulp Science is brought to you by Scott A. Ford. You can find me on social media. Just search Scott A. Ford.
Attention, citizens. It's time for Super Pulp Science.
This is Super Pulp Science, where we talk about how genre gets made. I'm here with my long-suffering co-host, Justin Curry, and an excellent guest today is here in our virtual studio, Scott A. Ford. Welcome back to the show. It's been so long.
Thank you. It's a almost yearly tradition having me back.
An annual tradition. Every year, your plants grow taller, I see, behind you.
Not last year. Yeah, I think we skipped last year, but I was on in 2018 and then 2019 also.
During the event.
Yes.
Have you on during the event. That's what we call it here in the studio, the event. Well, as long as we brought it up, I will mention for our viewers who have not heard of Scott or don't know his work that he is a writer, an illustrator. He works in the graphic novel space. At a very young age, he produced his own graphic novel series, Romulus and Remus. Then he went on to do some experimental works like Giant's Well, a very well-received book called Arkland, a magnum opus almost. And right now you're working on a project which is called Hologram Hunters. Did I get that right?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, so why don't you tell us, let's start on the good things. Let's not dig up any skeletons of the past just yet.
Okay.
All right. And let us first, why don't you tell us what Hologram Hunters is and what you're working on related to it?
Should we start there or more? How did you get into art? Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this to yourself, Scott? Why are you an artist?
Which question do you want me to answer first?
I want you to tell our viewers, our listeners, I should say, which one of us you like best by answering the question of the person you like best.
I guess I'll answer that simultaneously then with, you know what? I don't think that's possible. I'll just start with Hologram Hunter is my latest comic graphic novel that I've been working on. I still don't know, after all these years, I still don't know how to distinguish the two. It's going to be about 50 pages in the end, so I'm not sure if that technically makes it a graphic novel or if it's a comic. It really doesn't matter in the end. But yeah.
It's got words and pictures in a book.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I've been working on that for basically throughout the pandemic. I've been planning it for a number of years, but then I got a grant with the Manitoba Arts Council, which was really awesome and very generous of them to award me with that. I was super honored to receive that grant to work on this comic that was just an idea in my head for a long time. And it seemed like a lot of work and was very experimental, and this grant helped solidify my confidence in making this come to fruition. And it's taken a long time to do a relatively short book, but yeah, the Manitoba Arts Council was definitely helped boost that confidence and boost my financial capabilities to keep working on this experimental book, delving into a completely different style that I'd never worked on before, kind of a different medium than I had ever worked on before.
Was that part of the angle of getting the grant, is you're doing something a little more, you're doing something experimental that isn't usually done?
Yeah, that was absolutely my pitch on the grant, was that I want to try making a 3D anaglyph comic, which, if you don't know what anaglyph means, that's using classic blue-red glasses to view something in 3D. And it's something I had always wanted to try. And especially with this isn't just like taking 2D illustration and separating layers to make it to make it have depth. This is actually using 3D models and then rotating them and capturing them at different angles to make it more fully 3D with depth and angles, and a round shape has curves to it. And it's a subtle look, but I'm hoping it translates in the end that you can actually feel the shapes of these 3D models that I'm making on the page.
So on the 2D page,
yes,
the viewer will view it through like a pair of like 3D glasses, or is this an art technique that will give some other optical effect?
And no, it's through looking through 3D glasses, you should be able to view the like my scenes as if they're 3D.
Do you know the book Jim Curious?
I do. Yeah. That was actually an early inspiration for checking it out.
Absolutely love that book. It is such a cool experience to flip through it. My sons and I, you know, I got it almost as a, it feels, anything that comes with 3D glasses has a tendency to feel like a novelty when you first try it. But mm-hmm. when the illustrations, like the Jim Curious is a great example of, it's done so well mm-hmm. that you forget that there's this other apparatus and you're just along for an incredible ride. So if that was an early inspiration for you, I can't wait to see what you've done with it.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited for people to try it. And right now I'm just focusing on finishing it because my deadline is up soon. And so I don't really know what format it will take in, if I'm going to try to release it, partially digitally or just exclusively in print. I haven't figured that out yet. But I'm excited for people to finally view it in whatever form it finally takes.
I have an idea. Scott, I have an idea.
Okay.
How many pages is it?
It's not done yet, but it's going to be about 50.
We'll have to measure the hallways on this floor. But we could, let's launch it. Use our space to launch it. And print up 24x36 posters.
I don't know if quite that.
And let That's people massive. Just wander through your story.
That would be cool.
Till they
barf. That would be very cool.
We do have very long hallways that are fairly boring. That would be a super cool walkthrough.
Like they're all right. Everything's painted white on this floor anyway. So we could hang the whole floor and you could just wander through the Hologram Hunter experience. I suggest it because a gallery space, you know, there's always a money up front. There's all this bullshit, but sure. Just artist to artist, we could just let you have access to a great space.
That would be cool. I'll definitely keep that in mind. Thank you.
Ripping a book apart and like being able to walk through the whole thing. Super cool.
We printed all of our favorite pages from Snow Troll's Daughter and Red and See-Through, had them done up as canvases, and we did a similar style of show. It was much smaller because there were smaller little images. We just did one hallway. And I always, while we were doing that show, I was like, man, I wish this was the whole book big. But I don't think people would really appreciate that experience the way they would if they could fall into the picture, like in
with the glasses.
The glasses.
Could you talk process for a bit? Like you've done like shorter comics, really big comics. This is kind of like this is a little bit in the middle. Could you just talk for people who are kind of getting into making books, making graphic novels, your planning to almost completion process and what that looks like? Because you've done so many different types of projects. I imagine you've learned a lot of tricks along the way.
I have. And honestly, my process changes every single time. Because I think every new project I start, I think like, oh, I think I have a new strategy. I have a new pipeline from, you know, sketchbook, notebook to finished book.
Totally.
Of how to make this smoother. And so I think I've cracked the code every time of like how to do this most efficiently. And every time I'm sometimes right and sometimes a little bit wrong.
What that is, Dr. Mayer?
I don't know, Luis. I have never seen anything like this before.
It's important?
Yes, I think it is. Very important.
Yeah, honestly, like with every book, it's been different. With Romulus and Remus, my first book series, I was doing thumbnails, you know, about, you know, inch size thumbnails of the pages on just a scrap of paper, planning out the full book, and then penciling each page traditionally, just pencil and paper at the scale of the book, and then scanning those pencils and doing inks and colors digitally. With Arcland, it was the complete opposite. I was doing my pencils digitally in doing digital artwork, digital sketching, so that I could much more easily take past sketches of like, oh, I've got the same profile view of a character I've sketched already. I can just copy paste that as a reference for a future page, just to save time and also consistency, because that was a big thing of just making things look consistent across 260 pages. And so that was all sketched digitally, and then I printed them out at low opacity, and then I inked them by hand using pens and markers, and then scanned them back into the computer and colored it digitally, because I wanted that hand inked look. And then Giant's Well is completely different. That's all vector based. That was all made in Illustrator. And for this current book, it's all been digital. And I've actually been doing a lot of, all digital drawing, but I've been doing a lot of like planning out like thumbnails, page layouts, just using InDesign, just putting boxes down and then just typing text of like profile view or like wide shot or like this is when this thing smashes or something like that, just to like, because I can picture in my head, and that's not the problem. Is like I found I was spending like time, I don't know if wasted might be too harsh of a word, but in my brain it felt like time wasted of like I'm sketching out thumbnails and then I'll erase it and then I'll sketch it again. I don't actually need to sketch it. I can picture it in my head. I just need the box on the page just to puzzle piece these panels together of how much space does this take up? What can I visualize this panel of, I don't know, a character's face or an environment shot as a small panel, a narrow panel, a full page spread. Also, since a lot of this book is made using a 3D program, using SketchUp, the initial stages were making environment designs and assets and objects and characters. And so I had this, you know, set, this virtual set that I would spin the camera around, just take a quick screenshot, paste that into InDesign and see like, how does this fit? Oh, this actually, I thought this could be, you know, a long landscape panel and it doesn't actually look that great, or it looks weird next to these other panels. Let me squish that or change the camera angle and move that into a tall, narrow panel instead, in kind of a cinematographic? Cinematic?
I'll accept either. The judge will accept either.
Sure. You can cut around that. That's fine. in a cinematic way, like how the audience will view this scenery, these locations that I make. Because that is a big focus of this new book, Hologram Hunter, is it just kind of a mood piece. It is about these environments and exploring this space visually and really trying to plant the viewer in these spaces as if they were real and physical. And so a lot of time is spent just showing multiple angles of the same location using these 3D assets so that the viewer can hopefully feel like, that's what my hope is that they have an understanding of this space physically. It's not just an arbitrary kind of background sketch. They can look at it and see, oh, I know where the character has come from. They came from down that hallway that I see in the background of this other shot. And now they're around the corner here, and it feels like real living space that this character is in.
One of the big challenges in any kind of illustration project that is sequential is giving the reader a sense of the environment that isn't a distraction from the story, or vice versa. A character mm-hmm. can give a suggestion of a character that is not detracted by people being more interested in the environment. How do you manage these two things, or what have you been considering?
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because maybe I don't. maybe I want my audience to be distracted by the environment more than the character, because I love spaces, I love environments, and I draw a lot of inspiration from video games because I just love video game worlds and spaces, rooms, locations, because that sense of place, of being somewhere exciting and exploring that place, and seeing what's around the next corner, I find super fascinating and super exciting. And I want to convey some of that through my comics. And that's why I say that this book is kind of a mood piece. My main character doesn't even have a name because it didn't come up in the narrative. And so why force it? It doesn't really matter. They are just kind of, you know, they are the guide to the viewer through this environment. A good chunks of these pages are less about the character and more about the space invoking the reader's imagination of what is this place? How did it get like this? It's a very sci-fi industrial environment. And there's lots of inspirations that I can think of that invoke that feeling where the story doesn't explain what this environment is or how it got like this, or if this is even on Earth, or if this is some sci-fi world or whatever. And that sense of mystery is a huge part of the story, is just letting the imagination run wild of what is this place and how did it get like this.
Here it is, gentlemen. Exactly as I found it.
It's amazing. It's incredible.
In Greek storytelling, there's a tradition of the psychopomp, the character whose job it is to guide someone through the underworld. They go into a between space with them, and they sort of lead them on. In Dante's Inferno, he meets all kinds of psychopomps along the way. Is that what this character is? Is they're not really there to act in the space, but simply to be an anchor to the viewer, like you're with them along the way? Or are you looking through the point of view of that character?
You are looking through the point of view of the character. So maybe a bit of that. I think it changes from page to page. But they definitely have their own agency, and they have an objective through this narrative. There is a task at hand that this character is trying to accomplish through the story. I always kind of framed this book as like an animated short film. And I don't know why that specifically, but I've watched a lot of animated short films that really feel like this slice, this proof of concept, where it's not a full narrative, but the point of it is to experiment usually in animation, be that traditional animation or CG animation or both or whatever, an experimentation in style, and be a slice of what could be a larger narrative and hinting at a larger world, but it's just giving you just this small sort of grain of an impression of what this narrative is and what this sort of greater conflict is in this world that they're crafting, but it's just a little peek into that. And so I always framed it in that way, is this is hinting at a larger global conflict, that you're just getting this little slice of, oh, this is the day in the life of this character living in this space, and you get a little hint of what this sci-fi conflict is and what their role is in it, without actually explicitly explaining it or resolving it.
I love stories that do that, that just kind of hint at the bigger world, but don't spell it out. Are there any specific examples or inspirations that, that you think of that, that are similar to this? Like, my mind immediately goes to like the Iron Giant, the robot is never explained. Like his backstory is never explained. And if they had explained it, I think that would have, it would have ruined the story. Mm-hmm. Were there any inspirations, video game or movie or comic otherwise?
Oh, I might need to think about that a bit longer. Off the top of my head, and maybe this just is because I've been replaying it recently, is one of my all-time favorite video games, Machinarium, which I don't know if you've played.
Yes, I played that one.
Absolutely adore that game.
Gorgeous game.
And it is a big part because of the environments, and it's a point-and-click adventure game that's kind of hand-drawn in almost a watercolor style. I think it might be a French studio.
I don't think there's any. Are there words? Doesn't there's no dialogue. Like, yeah, garblish. So yeah,
there's speech bubbles that appear. It's a world of robots, and it's sci-fi, but it's depicted very fantastical. Mm-hmm. And the robots, you know, when they speak, a speech bubble will appear in a comic book kind of style, but it's just pictures explaining what they're talking about. It's, you know, one of the robots says like, "I've lost my dog," and so it's just a speech bubble with a dog and a question mark. But the overall game is really about this sci-fi city with these robots and just piecing together this strange environment that is more connected than you think it would, especially in such a quirky, you know, loose hand-drawn style. You expect it to be more abstract than it is, and then you see how these spaces connect, and you see how these characters connect, and what the conflict is in this place, or a hint of that conflict in this place, and it's so imaginative, and the music also goes a long way for that, just depicting the mood of this space, which is whimsical, but also such an intense sense of melancholy, which really resonates with me.
While we're talking about video games, I will mention to our dear listeners that I recently sat down with my son and played through your COG demo.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, a game you designed for in Dreams, which
that's
is
right.
For anyone listening who doesn't know, it's basically a video game within which you can build other video games.
Yeah. Dreams is a PlayStation exclusive game, although I've heard rumored it's coming to PC. Who knows if that's true? But it is, yeah, it is a game where you make games. So it's a $60 game or $40 game, I can't remember how much, that you buy like you would any other video game, and kind of like Minecraft or something like that, where you can make stuff in the game with using the game's tools. You can create games, but unlike something like Minecraft, it is entirely open-ended. It is, you are making stuff from scratch. You're not limited to the game's style or sort of limited assets or even like physics. You can completely manipulate that. So you're really just making video games.
Yeah, so in COG, you start as, and this will be my live review here. You start as this little like junk drawer creation, like the kind of stuff you would, if you were a kid going through the junk drawer, you'd find like a thimble and that's the head, and then you find like some sticks and those are the arms, and you'd find some twist ties and put it all together and make a little dude and go on an adventure through your house with this little dude. And COG sort of starts as this little made object character in a, like, between the walls of a house, and when you come out, you fall apart. You hit the ground and fall apart. And there's a little mechanic where you can pull all your bits back together, or you can roll around as broken bits. And you're searching for this, you know, there's a little bug that tells you like, oh, I need these objects, and then we can go on to somewhere else. And so you search this big environment of an old shed full of like antique furniture and, you know, record players and all kinds of weird cobwebs and bugs that attack you. And you're just trying to like navigate it, fighting your way through with what seems to be one of those little cocktail swords.
That's exactly right.
Right? Yeah. So just super fun, really immersive.
No. No.
Dreams is a game that came out last year, and I had my eye on it for a while, and then I decided to get it because I thought it would be fun. And it's interesting because I don't usually gravitate towards creative video games because that's my job. I don't like a game where it's like, oh, you can, I don't know, design your own house or I don't know, paint decals on your character or things like that. I don't usually
make up something like for that. Fun. Yeah, that's what I do because, all day. Yeah,
because that's my job, and I don't want to do that like within the confines of someone else's vision. Like I put that energy into my own work, but Dreams was different because of how much you are creating something from scratch. You are just creating a video game that you want to make. And the downside is that you can't monetize it. This is, you know, like making something in Minecraft. You're just making something within someone else's game that they are selling. But what I discovered after trying out Dreams is just how fast it is to make something that is pretty close to what I wanted it to be. You know, I made Cog in 3 months, just casually sitting on my couch, in an evening.
There's a sculpting function. So you basically can build the assets. You can draw from a bank of things and edit them, or you can sculpt them straight from scratch and then assign them the physics that are in a library. So if you want the sword to, you know, have certain motions, or if you want the characters to have certain things, there's a library of those, but they're all editable, so you can remix and reuse. One thing I really like about the way that Dreams works is that anytime you, the user, remix somebody else's work, the original user is added to the credits of your game.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and it's so that it always traces who the original creator is, which is really nice. But it is a platform of just about collaboration and community, where if you're not into sculpting or animation or music or any aspect of making a video game, you can just go into their library and they have stuff that Media Molecule is the company that made Dreams. You have stuff that they have made in-house, or you have stuff made by the community that you can go into a library and use in your game. So a lot of stuff in Cog, you know, there's a lot of assets that that I borrowed from the community. You know, like, search antique clock, and oh, here's an antique clock, and I'll put that as a little piece of set decoration because, you know, I could sculpt that myself, but it's fine. I don't need to, especially for something like this that was just, you know, kind of seeing if I could make this game that I had in mind more than crafting something that was like completely authorial. It was kind of a test to see if I could make this, because this is my first time ever making any game of any kind like that.
It's interesting to me that you use that phrase completely authorial, because if you you know, I, like you, will use 3D models or heavily reference or photo collage, or I will use all these things that already existed as a scaffold to build my final pages. And so, you know, there's an argument to be made that none of the work I've ever done is completely authorial. That if you had that ability to attach, like Dreams does, all the source code of everything that you ever touched, you know, there'd be like a 10-page biography in the back of the book.
And I think that goes for any artist in all of history. Like everyone is inspired by something else or someone else, even if it's from life.
And I think you just need to embrace that. If you're so focused on working in a vacuum, you're going to go crazy trying to trace where that idea actually came from, right? Like, so I think you just need to accept that that's it's a part of being creative, is you're inspired by things and they come through the filter of you and pop out the other side is sure. your art, and eventually you find your voice that way. But yeah, trying this focus on not being inspired by anything, I think that just slows you down.
No. Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. And maybe authorial was not the correct word to use. I just meant I was using stuff that other people had made.
Yeah. in this dream. That's what I was saying, is like yeah. we all are always using that. So then if we take that idea, what's the difference to you, or no, more interesting to me, how did it feel when you finished making Cog? And is it the same feeling you had when you finished Giant's Well, or when you finish Arkland, or when you finish a page of Hologram Hunters? Did it, like, emotionally, what's that like to you?
Yes and no, because it was very different, because, I mean, for a number of reasons. A, it's the first video game I had ever made. B, I was just surprised that I could make it, because I had this idea of like, oh, what if you're a character that's made out of junk, and if you fall from too high a height, you smash on the ground, and then you can rebuild yourself back together. And also there's, you know, a burning mechanic where you have little matches, you can burn away cobwebs, and also you have a grappling hook. Like, it was like a huge list of things that I didn't think I was going to be able to make. And that's what was so exciting, was learning that I was able to make it in dreams, able to make them pretty close to what I imagined and relatively quickly. So I was extremely excited.
Played through the game a whole bunch before I came in and tried it. And he got so frustrated with me because he was like, Dad, there's a story. And I was like, yeah, but there's a grappling hook function.
Yeah.
And I was just swinging all over and left, you know, like it was just fun to look at a big environment and be like, oh, how will I get there? Exactly. Oh, I can get anywhere.
Yes. And that was definitely a huge draw or a huge push, was I just wanted to make something that was a playground and fun to jump around. The story aspect was completely auxiliary. I think I just had objects randomly hidden around the room that I was like, oh, I should probably have.
And a little sad bug.
A sad bug telling you that they lost all their stuff, and so that you know to look for this stuff, and maybe there's a secret little prize if you get them all, or if you get most of them. But going back to my list of why this was exciting, this is also maybe my oldest idea ever. I had the idea for Cog in grade 11, and it was initially an idea for a stop animation film made out of junk, made out of and I have a partial sculpture of the original Cog, of an old thimble and like paper clips for arm, because I love the idea of a small character in a big world, in like a character that's only a few inches tall in the human realm, where, you know, climbing over a table is like climbing over a mountain. I love that idea, exploring something from a very small scale, where cracks in the wall can be doorways. And so, yeah, this was this old idea from back in high school that I had, that over the years, just in the back of my brain, I thought like, oh, that would be a fun idea for a video game, rather than a stop animation short film, an environment that you can explore. And then Dreams came out, and then I thought like, well, maybe I can give it a try. And I didn't think it would work. And then slowly but surely, I was like, oh, that I can do this. And then it turned into this game that I released. So that was definitely the most exciting part, was just making something that was such an old idea and matches pretty closely to that idea that I had, you know, over 10 years ago.
We got him! Don't kill him!
And then seeing, you know, the community reaction to it, of, you know, in Dreams, you know, people can comment directly on the game and like it and give you feedback. And so it was nice to see complete strangers saying like, I played it, I found all the objects, or like, I had a really fun time with it, or like, this thing is broken, it doesn't work the way it's supposed to. And I was like, oh, okay, I'll fix that, because that's a problem. dealing with bugs. Yeah, it was exciting and very different from my other process. But then also, like I was saying earlier, a little dampened by the fact that this is just a game on that I made that's in someone else's game that is not it was very fun to make, but it's like it's not something I can charge money for, and the time and energy that I put into it is not something that that is lucrative to me.
Is this just a stepping stone though? Because I'm thinking the amount of people that I've heard their origin stories of video games being RPG Maker, right? Like they spent years with their buddies in that old RPG Maker game, building their own video game, and now they make games for a living, or now they're like at an indie studio. Like it seems like games like this are often a springboard for people getting a little more into video games. So do you foresee in the next couple of years, like maybe jumping into like Unity or something more like that? And
I have thought about it for sure. I don't know because that is a whole other medium, a whole other set of tools that I have no experience with.
You got to make a programmer friend or two, I think.
Yeah. Yes. that is a big question because, I mean, I have so many ideas, you know, I don't know if any of them are good, who knows that, but I have no shortage of ideas for comics and, you know, animated short films or video games or I don't know, vinyl toys or anything like that, the restrictions that I place on myself of like, I'm just going to focus on comics right now. It does help me keep focus in a career sense because I will procrastinate on projects that I maybe shouldn't be focusing on right now. If inspiration strikes and I have the capabilities to work on something, I can't help myself but work on it. Even though I know I have three other deadlines that I absolutely should be working on those things, and those things I'm still very lucky to be doing art full time. I'm extremely privileged in that sense. And I know I should be working on those other things, but I can't help myself because it's so dang exciting. I am worried about that.
We talk about that struggle in this room all the time. Mm-hmm. Oh, I have an idea. I just have to do it.
I just got to put it out of my brain.
That's what I love about comics though, like all those things you mentioned, like a video game or a vinyl toy or even like a animated show or movie, if you make it a comic first, you can move to those other realms a lot easier than, you know, like if Hologram Hunter the book takes off or really impacts somebody in a real way, the chance of you being able to make it into a game are much, much better than you learning a little bit of how to make a game and making a demo. Like, I think you have better chance with the comic than you do like just starting the game. You know what I'm saying? And same with like the vinyl toy, you figuring out vinyl toy manufacturing from scratch is a difficult road. But if you make a great comic with a cool character and somebody sees that as a proof of concept and wants to make that into a toy, I think that's more likely to happen than you going just the vinyl toy road.
I think what you're talking about is like the notion of what is the best way, the best container to transmit the idea. It's hard to walk into a room full of people and say, I have a great idea for a video game. It's easier to say to that same group of people, I have a great idea that I made into a book. Mm-hmm. If you think it's a great idea, we can also now make it into something else, right? It's like breaking it down into a unit of consumption that allows people to accept.
That's what storyboarding is, right? I mean, storyboarding is kind of just comics. It's maybe not as highly rendered as a fully finished comic, but like that is the early stages of a lot of visual narrative projects is is storyboarding, and that's what comics is storyboarding as the final medium.
Hey! Hey!
You know, people, just in general, there's an old, you know, chestnut about writing that when you're writing a story, people can only handle one impossible thing at a time. Right? If you're writing science fiction or fantasy, only introduce one impossible idea at a time. Don't overdo it, or you'll lose or shrink your audience in a big way. And so if you're trying, as Justin is saying, like, oh, this would make a good video game idea, that's already a few impossible things. Is the idea any good? Would you finish it? Can I even see it? Do I know what the characters look like? These are all impossible things. When you hand someone a book or a graphic novel, so many of those impossible things are already solved. And now they're just deciding aesthetically, do I like it?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because when it comes down to it, those rooms full of people, it's really rooms full of accountants looking at the budgets and saying, can I come modify this? And if so, how will we decide what is a commodity? Yeah, that's the sad fine cutting line of working in the arts, is that at a certain point, someone has to figure out how to commodify it. Unless, lucky as we are to live in Canada, the Canada Council for the Arts will show up and say, ignore commodity for now, build the idea, which is like what I think is so great about Hologram Hunters.
And that's what I was lucky enough to do with Hologram Hunter, is without the Manitoba Arts Council grant, I don't know if I would have continued this book that I had made concept art for in 2014, I think, just using just traditional, or not traditional, but digital drawing, a flat illustrated image that I, at that time, had just learned how you can make something anaglyph 3D just by separating layers and changing the RGB channels. I didn't know that was possible before. And so learning that that is possible and just messing around with that, it was really cool to mess around with, to experiment with that off of a 2D illustration that I made and put on 3D glasses and whoa, it's popping out at you. Very exciting. But that was just a piece of concept art that was just a pipe dream for, you know, the last 6-7 years. What year are we now?
And so with Hologram Hunter, like, what is the plan when the book is finished and ready to print or distribute? Like, what are you doing with it? You froze.
Yeah, he froze, not us. Oh wait, but Jonas is frozen too, so maybe it is us.
Hello?
Hello, oh, yeah. You're back.
Oh, yeah, you froze there too.
Okay.
I don't know yet what the plan is with Hologram Hunter. I'd love to see it in print, and obviously to view it, you need 3D glasses. So even if it's released digitally as a webcomic version, hopefully viewers at home have 3D glasses. Doesn't everyone just have like 3D glasses sitting by their desk or by their phone that always in their pocket that they can whip out and read 3D comics on the go?
Well, anyone who bought a print from Nico Rudolph 3 or 4 years ago probably has a few sets.
That's of 3D right. Glasses. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know yet. I'd like to see it in print, but I can't confirm that yet, because I look at old projects that I did, like Boreal, that was a newspaper comic and was also a digital web comic. I haven't put that in print yet, and I'd really like to, but I just haven't gotten around to it. Because that was a job through the Manitoban newspaper, and so I was paid for that work to make that comic for 6 months. I can't remember how long it was. I got paid for that work, and that was a super great experience. But I haven't put it in a book yet, and maybe I will. I haven't decided yet. I'm just procrastinating on these
publishers. If you're listening,
I get right to the finish line and then I just don't cross over. I say, that's good, I'm done.
Yeah, publishers, if you're listening to this, Scott's got a drawer full of finished art for a book. He just needs you to put it in the store for him.
That's right. That's right.
Ready to go. Well, Scott, I have enjoyed catching up with you one more time, and we won't leave it 2 years again, I promise.
Sure. Yeah, you promise?
I promise. I promise. Okay. And I've said it publicly here now. It's on the record. If you need a gallery space that you don't have to finagle financing for, you've got our vow that we're in your corner to give you a good
thank you for that book. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Great. Well, this has been Super Pulp Science, where we've talked about how genre gets made. I'm Gregory Kamichuk, encouraging you to join the fight and make comics.